Good afternoon, everyone. Happy President's Day. This is the Senate Committee on Health Care and Human Services, Monday, February 18th. And I would like to open a work session on possible introduction of committee measures.
Madam Chair, I move LC 3154, dated 2/15/13, be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Cruz moves that LC 3115 be introduced. LC 3154 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 109. Sandy, bring us up to date on where we are there.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we had a public hearing on this bill on February 5th. It comes to the committee from the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Medicine. You may recall that this bill, currently the Naturopathic Medicine Board, only the chair can sign a subpoena to begin the investigation process. This bill is adding a designee of the board in addition to the chair so that investigations can be started and completed in a timely fashion. There's no fiscal impact and no revenue impact on the bill, Madam Chair.
And no amendment?
And no amendment.
All right.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 109 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 109 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Sandberg.
Excused.
Senator Knope.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Monahan.
Aye. Motion carries. And whose bill is this?
Oh, it was the agency bill, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Senator Shields will carry the bill.
We won't haze you.
With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 109 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 384. Senator Bates, please. Do you want to go up there too or
no?
No. Okay.
Madam Chair, as co-chair, next time this is written of the bill, I was asked whether I wanted to be on the, at the dais, and my response was, we have the expert there. That's good enough.
Well, thank you for calling me an expert. Madam Chair, for the record, Alan Bates. I'm a state senator from District 3, Southern Oregon. Also happen to be a family physician. The bill before you is rather innovative, and I've kind of asked myself a couple times why we haven't done this before. And people have asked me the same thing, and I tell them that's because we haven't thought of it, just hadn't thought of it. About 10 or 15 years ago, we did something that I thought was quite groundbreaking in the state. We started allowing people to have what we call EpiPens available to them for bee stings and other allergic reactions that can actually kill people. And we've saved lives of people being able to self-inject themselves or inject their spouse or inject a friend, giving them that extra time they need to stop an anaphylactic reaction that kills a lot of people in this country still and get them to the hospital so they can get proper care. This bill, in many ways, mimics that for a different reason. This is for people who are suffering an overdose of an opiate. Back when I was a resident in medical school and did some inner-city work and worked a lot in ERs, we use this pretty regularly. I've used it myself on patients. The results of the drug are really quite startling. It stops the effect of the opiate as far as people being able to breathe and or not breathe and brings them to consciousness and does it rather suddenly and dramatically, but it only lasts about 15 or 20 minutes and then drop back. And what you're trying to do is intervene in a situation where you have an accidental or intentional overdose with an opiate. And we're talking about drugs like heroin and narcotics that are commonly out there, especially methadone, which is a really serious one that can cause accidental overdoses very easily and lead to death. It brings your respirations back, brings your consciousness back. They sit up and talk to you. You find out what's going on, and you can repeat the drug if you have to. If you can't get them fast enough to a hospital where you can put them on a respirator, keep them on a vent, and keep them alive until the drug wears off and gets out of their system. So it's a life-saving drug. What's different a little bit about this drug is it can't be given by the individual themselves because obviously they're unconscious. So it has to be given by someone who knows them, a family member, a friend, but somebody who's involved in this. So we're talking about a system where we can get people trained to do this, as we train people for epinephrine, EpiPens, trained to use this medication in a way to save lives, gain that 15 minutes, gain a half an hour, till we can get them into a hospital, into an emergency room, get them on a vent, and then try to get them treated for their narcotic addictions or for whatever happens, an overdose. Sometimes it's suicidal effects going on, too. So it's a time-sensitive thing. It's something that allows us to get them to where we can treat them, hopefully save lives. You'll also be hearing from one of my patients who lost her son to this very problem with methadone. I think they're going to be coming on the line pretty quickly. This is a wonderful family that I've had the absolute honor and pleasure of taking care of for the last 30 years. And
Mr. Fish?
Are they on the line now?
Mr. Fish?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you are on the phone? Yes, okay. Senator Bates was just referencing you, and I wanted to make sure you were back on the line. Thank you.
Peter, can you hear me? Peter, can you hear me?
Yeah, faintly.
Okay. Well, thank you for doing this. I know that you've got a lot going on in your family right now, but this bill was designed to help people like your son that we all deeply miss. And I think if this had been available, he might still be here with us today. So the committee is interested in hearing your testimony, hearing your story. Is Jan there, too?
No, she's not. She's down at the golf course.
Okay. They actually run, they run and own a golf course. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. And she is presently, just got elected as mayor of Gold Hill, so they're a pretty active family doing a lot. Well, Peter, I'm going to stop here unless the committee has questions. I'd like to have them hear your story and what it meant to your family and what the loss was like and what a wonderful son you had. Because I think it's important we put a human face on this so we can get this bill through and maybe avoid future tragedies for young people also. And, Peter, I know this is painful for you, and I really appreciate you taking the time and stepping up and giving us your story.
So, Mr. Fish, please introduce yourself, and then please share your story with us.
Enter what?
Please introduce yourself and then share your story.
Okay. First thing I want to know is, can you hear me all right? Because
yes.
I could barely make out what Dr. Bates was saying.
Yes, we can hear you loud and clear.
Really? Okay. The second thing is, how much time do I have?
About 3 to 5 minutes.
Okay. This could be quite a long story, but I'll pretty much cut to the chase because I realize this is about accessibility to Narcan, and I think that's important. I'll just get into that side of it. Our son, Tom Fish, had been addicted, I believe, mostly to methadone and other pain-killing medications, probably for about 5 or 6 years before we really knew anything about it. And after about 2006, it kind of came to a head because he was really trying to get off it. And he went through about a year of Suboxone treatment as an outpatient. Mm-hmm. And was also working with a local organization called OnTrack. And after about a year of, I think he was stayed pretty clean on the Suboxone. He tapered down for a long time and eventually went off of it completely, probably about September 2008. And almost immediately relapsed and had the first of four overdoses that occurred in a period of about 6 or 7 months after September 2008. The first one happened at home. Well, the first three of them happened at home. The first one, I'd never seen him go through anything like that before. We were sitting in the living room watching TV, and we were having a conversation, and he was quiet for a little while, and I looked over at him, and he was sprawled on the couch with his head back and his mouth open, and when I checked, he wasn't breathing. So I called 911 right away and got kind of a crash course in CPR and attempted to resuscitate him with chest compressions and mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and for a few minutes, and then I heard the sirens outside, and then the fire department and the paramedics came in and revived him, and at that time, they used Narcan, administered, I think, by a tube down his throat because he was unconscious, and that brought him around pretty quickly and pretty violently. He was very sick to his stomach. Then they took him to the hospital and released him the next day. After that experience, he was willing to go into a residential rehab program, and we eventually found one toward the end of the year down in Santa Cruz. And he stayed there. He checked out early, I think, because of Christmas. He was only there about 4 or 5 weeks, and it was supposed to be 6. Anyway, he was clean down there, and then he came home and pretty much immediately relapsed. And there wasn't an overdose at that time that I know of, but he went back to the rehab program for several more months. Came home toward the end of February, and that's when the other 3 overdoses took place. 2 in early March. Both of these were at home, and it was essentially pretty much the same as the first. Paramedics and the ambulance and hospital, and this all happened fairly quickly before we could get our bearings and understand the severity of the thing, because he pretty much passed it off himself, that it wasn't that big a deal, and I told him, you don't know because you weren't there, you were dead. He said, well, that got me. I think he realized it himself. Anyway, the next and last overdose came in April, late April 2009, and unfortunately he was away from home. He was gone all day, and the first we heard about it was a call from someone who knew him that said he was in the hospital, and he did not survive that one. My understanding is that if Narcan were available to friends and family and people were trained in the use of it, it might make a difference in a case like this. So I wanted to contribute our story to further this. So that's about all I have to say. And if there are any questions, I'll answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Fish, so much for sharing your story. It really makes a difference when we have a human face to some of these policy decisions that we're making. And again, I'm so sorry for your loss, and hopefully we will be able to go forward with this legislation. Thank you so much.
I wish I'd been able to come up there personally, and that both of us had been able to. And if anyone, if this is necessary for this project in the future, we'd be glad to participate.
Thank you so much. Questions, committee? Again, thank you, Mr. Fish, so much.
And, you're welcome.
Should we go ahead and take Dr. Shames?
I'd like to make a comment, and I'm going to have to get down to my other committee I'm supposed to be sitting in right now, too. But I just want to kind of illustrate something from the story. Tom was a great kid. He was in his early 20s when he died. extremely talented musician, graduated from high school with good grades, got hooked up in this drug thing afterwards, had a little bit of depression going on. And you can see by what you heard there how chronic this becomes, and especially the younger
Excuse
ones.
Excuse me, I can barely understand what you're
I'm
saying.
I'm sorry, I'll speak up.
I think it's a bad connection.
And so we're just picking up on microphones. Tom was a great kid. And if you can get these children, these young people, through this first years of this and get them to proper treatment, you really can save lives long term. It was particularly concerning to me that the first episode, he went to the hospital, stayed overnight, and then was sent out the next morning. That's what's wrong with our mental health and drug and alcohol treatment programs. He should never have been sent home that first day. He should have gotten into an immediate program, probably in-house somewhere, you know, spent a month or two in those programs and really got some serious help to help prevent the next 2 to 3 episodes till he finally died. So I think it illustrates a whole lot of things, but the first step we're talking about here today is Narcan and saving these lives so they can get into programs that will help them. Thank you for taking your time to listen to me. I appreciate it. Any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Yes,
just a comment. The next individual on the phone, Dr. Seamus, who's the public health director in Jackson County, was part of the group that Tom Burns led to Montgomery, Alabama this last summer, and that's when he informed me about this and said that you were drafting a bill, and the more I heard about it, the more I thought, why in the world aren't we doing this already? So
it's embarrassing to say we haven't been doing
it. I just want to tell you, Senator Bates, that we don't have all the paperwork we need, but as soon as we do, we will move this.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Thank you. All right. Dr. Seamus, would you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Sure. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Seamus, Medical Director for Jackson County Health and Human Services. I'm the Health Officer for Jackson and Josephine Counties. I'm also the Medical Director of a local methadone suboxone treatment program in Southern Oregon. I've been a consultant and provider of addiction services for decades and also have worked as a family practice doc in addition to public health. So, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'm joining you to support Senate Bill 384 and the -3 amendments. So you've probably heard that Oregon is number one in misuse of prescription painkillers. Our state is awash in pills, with over 20 million controlled substances dispensed in Jackson County alone last year. And a number of people will transition from pain pills to the abuse of pills, and then often to heroin. And, you know, you've heard today about, you know, tragic consequences that pills and heroin can have on our loved ones, you know, like the unfortunate Tom Fish that we just heard about. As health officer, I read the medical examiner report for every overdose death that occurs in Jackson County, and I've been doing so since 2004. And the stories I read are just like the one you heard about today. We have youngsters who misjudge the potency of the heroin they're taking, patients who are treated for chronic pain and take a little more than they were prescribed, or combine their medications with alcohol or other drugs. A few months ago, two young people died in Ashland within 24 hours of each other from heroin overdoses. And last month, a 27-year-old woman in Grants Pass died of an overdose of methadone combined with Valium. So I read about these deaths month after month, year after year, and often there's someone else present at the time of the overdose, a friend or a loved one, who might have been able to save a life if they were informed and prepared to do so. Wilkes County, North Carolina, is a community about the size of Josephine County, and they created a program called Project Lazarus, where they combat the tragedy in their community having to do with overdose deaths. And what they've done is they've provided a naloxone as a key component of a program to prevent overdose deaths. And they found that since they started doing that, overdose deaths are down almost 70%. In Southern Oregon, a group of doctors, nurses, substance abuse counselors, and others have been meeting for almost 2 years to create guidelines for safe opioid prescribing. And we call ourselves the Opioid Prescribers Group. We finished our guidance document, and we're initiating a community-wide rollout of our plan to reduce drug overdoses. like Project Lazarus, we're hoping to incorporate naloxone dispensing as a key component of safe practice. So I think this drug is safe. It's certainly very effective. It's been a proven treatment for opioid overdoses. I think it's an important tool in our fight to reduce opioid overdose deaths, and I encourage you to support Senate Bill 384 and to make it law, and I'm ready to answer any questions you might have.
I think that I'd like to call Gary Oxman and Kathy Tome up first, and then we'll have questions.
Good.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Gary Oxman. I'm a public health physician, recently retired after a 25-year stint as health officer in Multnomah County, and I'm speaking here in favor of Senate Bill 384 and its Dash 3 amendments. And for disclosure, I want to be clear that I've been involved in the drafting of that bill and bill's development. I'd like to provide you with a little bit of background about the opiate situation here in Oregon, and also some specifics on the bill itself. As Dr. Shames and Dr. Bates mentioned, Oregon has a unfortunate distinction of being awash in opiates, and indeed we had the highest rate of illicit opiate use in the country in 2010-2011. And our youth under 26 are particularly at risk, and this is really seen in a couple of ways. One, the percentage of people who are under 26 admitted for prescription opiate treatment doubled between 1992 and 2011, from 13% to 27%, and we saw an even larger increase in the percentage of young people compared to older people who were admitted for treatment of heroin abuse, from 10% up to 41%. One thing that's really important to realize, and both Drs. Bates and Shames touched on this, is that regardless of the legitimacy of their manufacture and distribution, prescription opiates and illicit opiates, heroin in particular, have the same effect on the human body. They're really interchangeable, and indeed, people use the drugs concomitantly. So, and you know, one of the things that I'm really concerned about is a study that was done here in Oregon, up in Multnomah County, where back in 2011, what we found among heroin users was that 45% of them were first addicted to prescription drugs before they became addicted to heroin. So that's creating a very large population of new heroin addicts and new opiate addicts in the community. Let me say a few words about what Senate Bill 384 is all about. As you've heard, you know, naloxone or Narcan, which is one of the brand names, it's a safe and widely used antidote that can reverse an opiate overdose and prevent it from becoming fatal. Opiates cause their effects, including overdose, by chemically attaching to a tiny receptor sites in a brain. It's kind of like a key sliding into a lock. And what naloxone does is it basically pulls the key out of the lock, and it stops the chemical activity that leads to the adverse effects of opiates. Oregon law currently allows certain health providers, physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and some of the classes of EMTs to administer naloxone. But what we don't have is an authority beyond that, an authority like that that we have with use of adrenaline or epinephrine, as Dr. Bates talked about it. Basically, what Senate Bill 384 does is it authorizes public health departments and other organizations providing services to drug users to train lay people to recognize an overdose and to provide emergency treatment for that overdose, both with non-medicine techniques such as rescue breathing, as well as to administer naloxone. And the bill specifically allows those trained lay people to receive naloxone, to possess it, and to administer it in an emergency situation. One of the things I'd like to point out is that the approach of Senate Bill 384 is not radical. This is really becoming very standard practice in the country. Community-based overdose treatment programs have been in place. I think the first one started up in 1996, so it's been, you know, 10, 15 years. Across the nation, there's about 200 such programs. As of 2010, more than 50,000 people have been trained, and there were documented saves of 10 to 11,000 people's lives had been saved, overdoses reversed by lay administration of naloxone. And naloxone's being administered in a wide variety of settings across the country: medical clinics, drug treatment programs, emergency shelters, syringe exchange programs, and even the Fort Bragg Army Base has naloxone distribution, and a variety of law enforcement organizations have also been involved in the effort. The important thing is that these programs work, and cities and states with naloxone distributions have seen 37 to 90% reductions in overdose deaths. So this is really effective. It's also highly cost effective, even using very conservative economic assumptions. The drug itself, naloxone, has no potential for abuse. It's not something you can use to get high, and side effects are very rare. And there's been at least a couple of studies looking at the question of whether naloxone might increase drug abuse, and the evidence to date is that it does not increase abuse. So what does Senate Bill 384 do? Fundamentally, it expands access to naloxone. And as Dr. Bates mentioned, very similar in concept to what we do with epinephrine for B-stringing and other severe allergic reactions. It allows health departments and other organizations to train lay people to recognize an overdose and to treat an overdose. It does not require any organization to provide overdose response training. Organizations are entirely free to decide whether they're going to provide this training or not. There is no mandate around this at all. The bill requires each training program to have clinical oversight by a qualified physician or a nurse practitioner so that the actions of the program are medically appropriate and that they're also appropriately tuned to the activities of the organization. And finally, it authorizes the health authority and the Board of Pharmacy to adopt necessary rules. The health authority specifically will address training standards, and this will assure consistent and high-quality training statewide. And the Board of Pharmacy's rulemaking authority is really intended so that there are safe and practical mechanisms to distribute the drug. So to me, from a professional perspective, the bottom line is that these opiate overdose deaths, many of them are preventable. Senate Bill 384 creates important tools to respond to our current opiate crisis, and I'm very confident that the bill will save lives if enacted. And thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Let's go with the final testimony, and then we'll open it up to questions.
Thank you. Chairman Montes Anderson, members of the committee, I am testifying today in support of Senate Bill 384.
State your name for the record.
My name is Kathleen Tomes-Rue, and I am a community health nurse with the Health Department, Multnomah County. I've worked as a public health nurse for over 20 years. In fact, I know you. The story I'm going to tell you today is about my stepson, Jacob. He was 28 when he died of a heroin overdose. Until that time, I'm not aware of any ODs that he had had, but from the time he was an adolescent, he had struggled with addictions to prescription opiates, as well as alcohol, marijuana, and so forth. By the time he was in his, I would say, mid-20s, he had progressed to heroin. He was a great kid, just like Tom, the young man we just heard about. He was compassionate, loved animals, he was smart, had a great life ahead of him, but due to these addictions, he just couldn't get ahead. He joined the National Guard when he was maybe 22, I would say. Moved back east for a while to live with his mom, or close to his mom, and got into the heroin there, we believe. That was probably 2006 or so. He proceeded to be discharged from the National Guard due to the addiction problems. He tried to hold down jobs, couldn't do that, and was struggling so much that he came back and lived with us in 2009. That was June of 2009. Actually, we didn't know that he had the heroin problem then. We didn't communicate that much with his mom, and so sadly to say, we couldn't get him help that he needed right away. We had to kind of find out for ourselves, so to speak. And as many of you may know, some of the patterns that go along with addiction, especially opiates, stealing, odd behaviors that are very much compatible with this type of addiction, alerted us that he had a problem. So his dad confronted him, and he admitted that he had the heroin problem. His father helped him get into detox at that time, which he went to Hooper, which some of you are familiar with. After Hooper, instead of going into treatment, he came back to live with us, which was mistake number one. It would have been my preference that he go into residential treatment, but as things happened, he didn't. So he came back to live with us. The pattern started all over again. We had to ask him to move out because of the stealing. For a short while, he was homeless, ended up in jail, stealing, jail, detox, treatment, and the cycle was such that I think it was 2011, August, he was in jail, had the option of staying in jail at that time or going directly into residential treatment. So he chose treatment. He had been through 6 months of treatment the year before that, or maybe it was earlier that year. Anyway, I don't know the exact time, but he did really well. However, when he was out of that, he immediately relapsed. So we were hopeful that this time he would be more successful when he went into treatment from jail. So that was, I would say, early August 2011. And the sequence of events on the day that he died, which was August 23rd, he was doing quite well in the treatment center. We were being very supportive. We learned a long time before this day that we couldn't give him money. We supported him in other ways, bringing him clothes when he was in treatment or on the street or wherever he needed things, meals from Sisters of the Road, what have you. But what happened on that day, I just want to relay because this is the most important part and the reason that we feel that had naloxone been available to Jake that day, he may have survived. So basically, that day, Jake and another man had just finished eating their, I believe it was their evening meal. They went into a bathroom that was close to the billiard room in the treatment center. It was a men's residential treatment center. And what happened was they were in there together for about 15 minutes, and some of the other residents noticed that they'd been in there with the door closed for quite some time. So they went to one of the counselors there and advised them of this, or him in this case. And he immediately went to the bathroom, tried to open the door, but the door wouldn't open. Apparently it wasn't locked, but what had happened was Jake and this other man had shot up in the bathroom, flushed the works, and Jake had passed out. He was lying unconscious against the door, so of course they couldn't open the door. So the counselor asked the other man who was in the bathroom but wasn't unconscious to please move Jake so that he could get in, which he did. And when he discovered that Jake was unconscious, had vomited, aspirated emesis, of course, 911 was called. And at that time, the counselor tried to resuscitate him, or mainly, first of all, turned him to his side, tried to remove the emesis, wasn't totally successful at that. He was still alive, had a pulse. He continued to try to remove emesis. At some point, he lost his pulse, and CPR was started at that time. The counselor had told us that it probably took about 20 minutes before EMS arrived, which is kind of a long time. And in that time, all they could do basically was CPR, and when they did that, however, emesis did continue to come out. So, but then EMS arrived. They tried to resuscitate him and were not successful. So that's pretty much what happened. He was not revived after that. The other man who was in the bathroom was taken to jail. We never found out what happened from him, from his participation in the event.
Thank you.
But that's pretty much it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks for sharing that story.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Questions? Senator Steiner Haywood.
Thank you, first of all, for your testimony. I can only imagine how difficult it must have been for you and your husband, and you know, for any family that's lost a child in this way. From a very technical perspective, I'd just like to clarify with Dr. Oxman and Dr. Shames. Looking back in Oregon statute, it looks as if prior to either 1981 or 1989, it wasn't legal for anyone other than a health professional to administer epinephrine for anaphylactic reaction. And to my mind, I think this is analogous, and I'd like a correction if you think I'm wrong. I think this has the level of safety, if not more so, that epinephrine has, and we believe, as we did, we heard the previous legislative concept that we're going to be moving forward at some point, that epinephrine should be more widely available to save people who have anaphylactic reactions. Is there any reason to not say that this is essentially analogous to providing that life-saving medication more widely? We know that we give parents of kids who have known anaphylaxis to peanuts auto-injectors of epinephrine. It's the same, basically, right? I mean, yes. In terms of the safety profile.
Yeah, Chairman Sanderson, Senator Steiner Haywood. Yes, it's very analogous, and you're correct that actually naloxone is a much safer drug to administer than epinephrine.
Yeah. I just want to be sure. I mean, we have a path for doing that for similar dangerous conditions in this state.
Yeah,
so
very
I think it's a great bill.
Great. Seeing no other comments, thank you very much. We don't have the paperwork, so we need to move on.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll roll it over till Thursday.
Yeah. Can we roll this over to Thursday for work session, or?
Madam Chair, I'll wait till I get the fiscal and then schedule it at the next meeting after that.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah. That's fine.
Great. Okay, with that, I'd like to close the public hearing on 384. Colleagues, we have two more bills, and we need to be done by about 4:15 or so, only because we're watching a film that everyone is invited to on homelessness with the House in this room, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 163. And Craig Campbell, Russ Spencer. Oh, wait.
Yeah.
No, that's 164. I was doing 164. Sorry. Craig Campbell, Russ Spencer, and Christopher Clark.
Just so you know, the next meeting of the hospital tax work group is also tonight, so I have to go
to
that
one. Is that your testimony?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead and just hand that to her. So I'm not blowing off your movie for no reason.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of Pfizer Pharmaceuticals in support of Senate Bill 163. I will keep my comments very brief because there are other people who will be speaking after me who are not only more knowledgeable but also can articulate better some of the reasons for this bill coming forward before you. What this bill essentially does is it takes what are generally referred to as a fail-first protocol, which is when a physician wishes to prescribe a certain type of pain medication that he is required by the insurance policy to prescribe other types of medication to try to accomplish the same thing, usually for lower cost. And what this bill does is it limits those protocols to two times only. Some of those protocols can require that a person try a medication and wait for a period of 30 to 60 days to find out if it works, and that's called the fail before they can try the second, and then in some instances a third and more before the physician can prescribe the medication that they wish to prescribe in the first place. What this bill does is it limits it to two fail-first protocols, and it then sets the time that the patient has to stay on the medication. That is given over to the physician to determine rather than the insurance policy. This bill limits that to pain medications only. This is an industry-wide practice. It deals with a lot of other medications, but this bill only limits the fail-first protocols to pain medications. And with that, as you might guess, the reason why it's focused on pain medications is because if a pain medication isn't working, specifically with chronic pain, you don't want to have to wait 30 days before you can move on to the next medication to find out if you can find one that succeeds. And that's essentially what the bill is intended to do. And I can certainly answer any questions if you have any.
Let's hear from the panel first.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Russ Spencer. I represent Pfizer Pharmaceuticals, and thank you for hearing this bill. Very brief comments in light of your tight schedule here. I just want to state that, you know, why is Pfizer bringing this issue forward along with a coalition of others? We do have a financial interest in the passage of this bill. We would benefit from it. That's clear, that's obvious, and it's transparent. It doesn't work for our model if patients cannot get access to the medicines that they need. This is a modest attempt at putting reasonable limits around fail-first limitations. As Craig referenced, it is only targeting pain. That makes sense to us because of the acute nature of the need of patients during pain. I can speak to you wearing a patient's hat who went through 2 years of serious back injury and was on morphine for a long period of time. I understand, in a way I never did before, the impact of chronic pain and the need to really control it. So I'm sympathetic from that perspective. You will hear some opposition to this. Some of the opposition also has a clear financial interest in that, and that's appropriate, and that's fine. I would ask you to consider those two ends. They kind of cancel each other out, and let's listen to the people that are directly affected by this. The most important component of this, I believe, is the power that it gives the physician to be able to make the determination of what's best for the treatment of the patient that they are seeing at that particular time, rather than painting with a broad brush. Most people would agree that the practice of medicine is both art and science, and that's hard to capture in a standardized policy. With that, I'd be happy to defer to those who really have a story to tell here.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Christopher Clark. I've been an administrator and manager for medical clinics for the past decade in Coos Bay and in Eugene and now up here in Kaiser. I've worked with orthopedic surgeons, neurosurgeons, and pain management physicians. And during that time, I've seen firsthand the frustration and irritation of not just the physicians and staff, but also of the patients having to go through all these steps to get the medication eventually, hopefully, that the doctor wanted to get to them in the first place. There were many times working in Coos Bay, we'd have patients come up from Brookings, which is, you know, 2-3 hour drive in pain, 2 hour drive, time and time again, only be told, well, we have to try this medication next, and then try this medication. Okay, and let's try this medication. For numerous times, and these patients are in pain for months and months until eventually, hopefully, getting the medication the doctor wanted to prescribe to them in the first place. The insurance companies limit this and tie our hands, and there were many times talking to an irate patient and just telling them, we can't do anything. It's your insurance company that's saying, we have to go through all these steps before you can get the medication that the doctor wants you to have. And to me, you know, saving money for the insurance companies by not prescribing these medications in the first place, it's irritating, it's poor patient care. Not only would this bill increase efficiency and save costs on the clinical level, but being able to prescribe a medication for the patient the first time, or maybe the second time if it doesn't work, it's just better patient care, and we're better able to represent and help our patients. If there are any other questions, thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. With that, I'd like to call up Amy Carmona, RN, Dr. Carl Balog, And then Tony Randlimovich via the phone.
Tony, are you on the phone?
Sam, I'm here.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead while we wait for the others? Please introduce yourself.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I am. My name is Tony Radmilovich, and I am from Bend, Oregon. And I'm calling in today in support of Senate Bill 163 because experience I've had with the fail-first procedure. And at the time, I had no idea what it was called. I just knew that something was foul and was making things very difficult for me. And I'll start by saying that it took a few years for my doctor to finally diagnose a form of myalgia that had worsened to the point where I could barely walk. My legs, my wrists, my arms were all in intense pain. And once he diagnosed that, he had he prescribed a medication that he was fairly confident would work, and it did. It worked very, very well for me. And I was fortunate that for about a year and a half to 2 years, that particular medication made a huge difference in my life. While it didn't make me completely pain-free, it did reduce it to the point where I could function fairly normally. One day I opened up an envelope from my insurance company, and there was a notice telling me that they would no longer cover the medication that I had been taking. It was very expensive, and it was virtually impossible for me to afford that medication on my own. So I had to go see my doctor, who said that he had received the same notification, and he was required by the insurance company to try other medications to see if they would be as effective as what I had been taking. And at that point, I was pretty reluctant, but we didn't have any choice. So he prescribed one specific medication. At this point, that was one of the lower-cost medications, and I thought, well, okay. I kind of looked at it from the bright side and thought, if we can find a medication that works as well and costs a lot less, well, you know, pretty happy with that. So I took that for about a month, month and a half, and it wasn't working. And I went back to my doctor and told him that. He said, well, you have to continue for, and I believe at that point it was 90 days to see if it would be effective. And my pain returned to the point where, once again, I was on the verge of being almost unable to walk. I could get around, but I really couldn't do anything with my hands or my wrists. So after 3 months of that medication, we obviously found out that it wasn't working, and I was hoping that I could go back on my original, but once again, he said, no, they required that we try yet another. So he prescribed that, and we met with pretty much the same result as the medication before. There was maybe a small difference. It was a little bit better, but still I wasn't functioning well at all. So after another 90 days of a lot of pain and not being able to do my normal work, not being able to function around the house, we tried, I went back to the doctor, and he said, okay, well, we have to try one more. And I held, well, third time's the charm, but by this time, things are getting pretty bad. I have to my wife is legally blind, so basically taking care of things around the house and household chores, driving, everything is up to me. And being in this amount of pain made it very difficult to do just the basic things that we needed to do to maintain a household. At this point, I'd been several months in a lot of pain, and I was having a heck of a time trying to get through. So finally, after the end of that trial period, the doctor said, okay, well, I finally got approval from the insurance company. We can put you back on the original medication, which I went back on, and it worked, and within probably 3 to 4 days, I was back to being almost fully functional and out of that severe cycle of pain. But in the meantime, I had gone, at several months, suffering pain in my arms, my wrists, my hands, not being able to do things. Plus, I racked up, I don't know how many extra doctor visits trying to sort out all the medications, which I wouldn't have had to have done had I been able to stay on my original pain meds. And these doctor visits at $238 each became a financial burden on us just as well as the pain burden. So through all of that, it became very frustrating, and it just seemed like a total waste of time, money, and an unnecessary amount of pain and suffering. My doctor was frustrated because he felt like he was being subverted because he had the training. He knew what he thought was best for me and was very upset at the insurance company for not allowing him to give the best level of aid.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I really appreciate it. We really like to hear these human side of, legislation that we're looking at. And again, thank you so much for participating.
Well, thank you, and I just hope that this passes and other people don't have to go through the same kind of pain and the same kind of frustration that I did.
Thank you so much. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Madam Chair and members of the panel, good afternoon. My name is Amy Carmona, and first of all, I'd like to thank the panel for the opportunity to offer my testimony. I'm appearing before you today in more than one role. First, as a registered nurse, and I have National Board Certification in Pain Management and also in hospice care. Secondly, as a member of the Oregon Pain Management Commission, and of course I am not authorized to speak on behalf of the commission. And thirdly, I am a chronic pain patient myself. I have two debilitating conditions which have kept me from maintaining paid employment since 2009. However, I serve on the commission on a voluntary basis, and I also stay abreast on current evidence-based practice on a regular basis and attend continuing education activities. I also serve as a volunteer for the National Patient Advocacy Foundation, which is another way for me to speak out on behalf of chronic pain patients who are less able to articulate their needs. Today, I want to approach you from both a personal and a professional perspective. My interest in pain management arose when I was a home hospice care nurse. And this was before I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia myself. When I was serving as a case manager for patients who were mostly residing in various forms of long-term care, I became aware of a population that had a high incidence of chronic pain, which was often unrecognized and way too often undertreated before hospice came along. I lost my job in 2009, after several years of increasingly severe chronic pain. I obtained a referral to a pain clinic in 2009, and at that point was diagnosed with fibromyalgia and placed on a medication regimen which included Lyrica and Cymbalta, which are two of the three FDA-approved medications for fibro. And I might add, neither of those are opioids, although I am on opioid medication as well. I was medically stable on this drug regimen, and this did increase my ability to function in some capacity. In early 2011, my COBRA coverage from my employer expired, and the only option I had was the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool because of my pre-existing conditions. And that, as you may know, is administered by Regents. When I went into the pharmacy to pick up several refills I ordered for the first time under this new coverage, the pharmacist informed me, quote, "Your insurance company doesn't want you on Lyrica. They would like you to take something else. And your insurance company doesn't think you should be on Relpax for your migraines. They want you to use something else." There was also a third non-pain medication for which coverage was denied. With my two debilitating conditions, there are many days I'm unable to drive and consequently sometimes get medications when I'm almost out or already out. And in this instance, I was down to one day of Lyrica, which is a medication that should not be discontinued abruptly like many other medications and should be instead tapered down slowly. This sudden discontinuation led to acute withdrawal symptoms, which was the case with one of my other denied medications. My pain physician, Dr. Stuart Rosenblum in Portland, promptly sent a letter of appeal to Regents saying that this medication was medically necessary and indicated, and his letter was also denied. When Regents told me which two medications they required me to, quote, fail first, I informed them that I had already been prescribed these medications in the past. One was Flexeril and one was Neurontin. But I was told I had to submit proof of this, which meant going back to my primary care clinic and having someone go through my voluminous chart to go back and find this information. I had to wait quite some time for someone to be able to do this. And these two drugs, neither of them is considered medically indicated for fibromyalgia as an effective treatment. So 6 weeks elapsed before I was able to get this situation sorted out and get the Lyrica restored. At that point, just as I'd had to go through acute withdrawal symptoms when the Lyrica was stopped, I had to go through the side effects that one experiences when you're first going on to the drug, which include increased dizziness, which you already have with fibro, and numbness in my hands and hand tremors. From a professional perspective, I would like to comment that we are all concerned about the escalating cost of healthcare, and of course, medications are a very large part of this. It's true that patients often come into their provider's office requesting specific medications by name that they've seen advertised in magazines or maybe advertised online when an older medication would be effective and is available for a much lower cost. However, an arbitrary protocol or algorithm by an insurance company should not take priority in this situation when it's the physician who actually knows the patient best and is in the best position to decide what treatment is appropriate.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Carl Balog. I've been practicing chronic pain management for the past 10 years in Portland, Oregon. I'll be brief. I support the bill because I think it offers a reasonable compromise between the clinical needs of the physicians and their patients and the sometimes competing needs of a insurance company.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. I'd like to call up Tom Holt, Chaba Mera, Dr. Chaba Mera, Sean Karbowitz, and Elise Brown. And colleagues, we're going to move Move Senate Bill 164. We're going to reschedule that for next Monday, February 25th, 13, because we're running out of time.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt, Director of Government Affairs for Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, here in opposition to Senate Bill 163. I appreciate my friend Russ pointing out the financial interests in this bill. The financial interest that we have is on behalf of the 750,000 Oregonians who ultimately pay for the cost of care through the health plans that we administer. There is a substantial cost to this bill, to our members, and I brought with me Sean Karbowitz, who is the Director of Pharmacy for Regents RX, which designs and implements our prescription drug benefits, and Dr. Chaba Mira, who is our Medical Director for Oregon. And with that, I'll turn it over to Sean and Chaba.
Chairman Mona Sanderson, committee members, my name is Chaba Mira. I'm Regents Executive Medical Director for the Blue Cross Blue Shield Plan of Oregon. I have 23 years of clinical experience taking care of all ages, acute and chronic care, including treating patients with pain. In addition, I have 17 years of being a medical director in the health plan environment and dealing with the issues that we all face in healthcare today. We at Regents oppose Senate Bill 163 because it seeks to interfere with with step therapy, which is a well-established, evidence-based, rigorous procedure that is unbiased toward any specific pharmaceutical company and supports safe, effective patient care. Step therapy offers our members equally effective products based on application of scientific evidence and sound medical practice. The factors that go into developing a step therapy for any particular drug in order are, number one, consideration for patient safety, secondly, the effectiveness of the treatment, and third, the cost, which must be borne by employers and our members throughout the state of Oregon. The actual process which is being challenged by this bill is, I will describe because I think it is relevant. It starts by doctorate level individuals doing a critical analysis of the scientific literature around any medication. Then practicing clinicians, such as Dr. Balog, who have expertise in a particular area of that drug, will be requested to review and comment on the recommendations that are being made. Based on this, on these first two steps, the Regents pharmaceutical formulary and the step edits that are placed in there are reviewed by other clinicians before these they become medication policy guidelines. During the year, we get feedback. Our clinical staff review the scientific literature that may be coming out throughout the year, and if necessary, we will adjust and we will make modifications to a policy, even mid-year. Generally, these policies are reviewed annually, but if something really important comes up, we can make modifications. We make changes to the step therapy. The step therapy pieces of this in the same manner. You have before you an illustration of some of the claims. Do you? Oh, right now. So on relatively short notice, we did a look into our 2011 data, pharmacy data, and for about the 50 medications that require step therapy, there were approximately 300,000 claims. This is Regents-wide, but this is just to give you an idea of the scale of what we're talking about. Of these claims that were submitted, because the vast majority of physicians do understand the steps taken prior to asking for a particular drug, 280,000 of these claims went through without any formal review. They were automatically adjudicated by the system because they followed the step therapy process. There were about 600, I'm sorry, there were about 20,000 denials altogether, but only 600 of these claims were appealed. And the point that I'm trying to make there is, of the 20,000 denials, we sent information back to the clinician saying, you know, these are the other medications you should consider based on critically analyzed scientific data and input from other experts in this area. And so only 600 of these 20,000 went on to an appeal, meaning that the vast majority of these physicians appreciated the additional information and were able to accommodate by using another medication. Of the 600 claims out of, now we're talking 300,000 claims total, only 200 were continued to be denied. In other words, they just did not meet the criteria for us to be able to provide the additional medication. With that, I'll pass it on to Sean.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. I'm Sean Karbowitz. I'm a pharmacist. I'm the Director of Clinical Evaluation and Policy at Regents RX, which is the internal PBM for Regents and the Regents Health Plans. I'm a licensed pharmacist. I've been a pharmacist in Oregon since the 1900s. I wanted to comment, first of all, we're opposed to Senate Bill 163. It will raise costs and interfere with our ability to encourage safe, effective medications before covering new medications that do not have an established track record of safety. First of all, we don't even use the term fail first among my staff. We don't want our members to fail therapy. We're encouraging the use of safe, proven, cost-effective medication therapy. I have a couple of examples of medications that we have evaluated specifically in the realm of pain management and have come to conclusions that are similar to what the Oregon Health Resources Commission's evidence-based review has found. So there's groups of medications that Pfizer has branded products and has a financial interest in, that we do have step therapy requiring the use of safe, effective, less costly medications before we can cover these costly branded therapies. Specifically, NSAIDs like Celebrex. The Oregon Health Resources Commission did not find that Celebrex, for example, has proven advantages in terms of effectiveness over the 20 or so generically available NSAIDs currently available. They found limited circumstances where Celebrex may have some safety advantage, but it's a very small type of use or scenario. Lyrica for fibromyalgia, for example, we do require the use of generically available medications with a long track record of use in fibromyalgia. Relpax was mentioned earlier. That's a Pfizer drug. There's generically available triptans for the treatment of migraines. One of the questions that came up as I was listening to some of the testimony and thinking about this was the potential expanding scope that could result after the passage of this bill. Is it just for medications that have an FDA-approved indication for pain, or does it impact all therapies that are used for indications that have pain as a component of that indication? So, for example, a new Pfizer medication that was just FDA approved is tofacitinib or Xeljanz for rheumatoid arthritis. Rheumatoid arthritis has pain associated with it. There are approximately 6 FDA approved medications for rheumatoid arthritis right now that are biological medications, very costly yet very effective. But these medications have a proven track record of safety. They've been on the market for a while. And we are considering putting step therapy in front of Xeljanz, unproven track record of safety, new mechanism of action. We don't know how effective it is relative to the other therapies that are already available. So Senate Bill 163 impacts our ability to encourage the use of safe, effective therapies, and for that reason we're opposed, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
I think one of the problems I have is, as Amy Carmona talked about, she had been on, and I don't know how many patients you have that have been on another medication and it was working, and then they come into the system and then you, the insurers say, no, you can't be on this because you haven't gone through the step therapy, when actually she had in the past. So to me, I see that as undue pain for a patient, especially if they've been on a medication for a while. Can you respond to how many of those that you have and why you couldn't grandfather them in?
I absolutely can. So it's not our intent to interfere with effective medication therapy. However, patients are often put in a dilemma when their physician starts them on medication samples prior to considering, again, safe, effective, cost, less costly medication therapy. In the circumstance where a member was successfully treated and established on a medication, perhaps through another health plan, or they were paying for the prescription out of pocket, and they were truly established on the medication therapy, under those circumstances, we're much more likely to approve coverage because that patient has been established on the therapy. Our organization looks at samples as just that, medication samples, that they're strictly for a short-term use or just to kind of try to see if the medication might work. We don't consider in our organization that a person is established on therapy if they're simply using a medication sample. So in that circumstance, we would ask the physician to consider less costly generic medications first.
It was just that she had said she had actually been on a step therapy and had to wait to find that information and get it to you, et cetera.
So, Chair Monis Anderson, to your point, in these step therapy processes that we have electronic edits, so our system looks back in the system to see if there's any claims for those generically available medications. And what Dr. Mara was referring to was that the vast majority of the time, that data is there, those data are there, and so the claim just passes through without interference. If there is a circumstance where a patient has had one of those, has had previous therapy that hasn't worked for them, there's an appeal process. And through that process, we ask the patient or the physician to simply let us know. Our organization does not require chart notes. We don't require excessive documentation. In fact, in many cases, our customer service specialists are given instruction to simply take the word of the patient or the physician at the time when they're on the phone. If it does go to an appeal or to an appeal panel, the patient's going to, or an administrative law judge at that point, if the patient says they're on it, they were on it.
It just seems that it would be in the best interest of the patient to keep them on that drug until she can prove that they've already, you know. To me, that makes more sense.
And to your point, if the patient was getting samples from the doctor, perhaps the doctor can continue to give samples until we get that information. Okay. Thank you very much.
Any other comments? Okay, Elise.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, Elise Brown for AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans. And in the interest of time, I did want to go on the record for the rest of the Oregon member plans. It was great to hear from Regents, but I did, for the record, want to say that AHIP and the rest of the Oregon member plans stand in opposition to this, too. Regents' testimony did include all the right issues around patient safety and saving consumers money. So I'm not going to repeat. I did have some great testimony, but we'll just for the record stand in opposition. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. And that's it. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if indeed there's going to be further action on this, I might suggest that we consider oncology drugs as well.
All right. Thank you very much. I would like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 163, and hopefully some of you will be able to stay for the film on homelessness.
It was
you don't have popcorn.
It was filmed in my community, and I think it'll be an eye opener. With that, we are adjourned.